When Def Leppard burst out of a Sheffield spoon factory in 1979, they were swiftly installed as the child prodigies of British heavy metal.
We just had ridiculous belief in our own ability. I mean, it was obviously youthful arrogance, I suppose.
The Def Leppard story starts here in Sheffield. Back in 1978, when this used to be an engineering works, Steve Clark worked here as a lathe operator. Rick Savage was a trainee technician for British Rail. Rick Allen was still at school, and I used to work in the basement of a steel factory.
When I was about 13 or 14, we were starting to get bands, people that were interested in being in bands, just basically school kids. And we used to congregate at the youth club of Tapton School every Tuesday night. And basically, whoever had a guitar or whoever could play guitar would come in and start playing. And we didn't really have any a band as such. It was just a congregation of people that were learning to play, whether it be drums, bass or whatever. And from that, I got to know Pete Willis and a few other people that we decided, say, a year later, that we wanted to make something more, a little bit more serious out of it. Pete Willis knew Joe, and Joe, I think, had tried everything under the sun to be in a band. He'd tried playing drums, he'd tried playing guitar, and he just turned around to Peter one night, I think, and said, "Yeah, I'll sing." So Pete said, "Okay, fair enough," and that was the beginning of it, really.
On Through the Night, our first album, was released in March 1980.
Hello, welcome to Rock and or Roll. I'm your reluctant host, BJ, and this episode begins a series of episodes that I'm going to do about Def Leppard. Going to take it album by album and have a different guest co-host for each record. At least going to go up through Slaying with an individual episode for each album, and then I'm not sure yet how I'm going to approach the post-Slaying output by Def Leppard. But for this episode, the first episode, we're going to just talk about the band for a little bit, and then we're going to focus on their first album, On Through the Night. And my special guest co-host for this episode is Joe Royland from the Sit and Spin video cast. Hey, Joe.
Hey, BJ, thanks for having me. Glad to be here. I was hoping that I would get at least one of the two Pete Willis albums. Three, technically, if you count Pyromania. But
yeah, I count Pyromania.
Let's say three.
Yeah, I think Phil Collin only played maybe a couple guitar solos on that, and Pete Willis did a lot of writing and played, so. Yeah, I always say that it's the Pete Willis years. I don't know about you, but for me, Def Leppard are top five band all time. But when I say that to your average person, they think, "Pour some sugar on me," you know? But yeah. I'm talking Pete Willis years. It's like I have favorite bands where, like, one of my favorite bands is Soul Asylum, but when you say that to the average person, they just know Runaway Train. And
right.
For me, it's Soul Asylum 1986 through, like, 88. That band, in that, you know, microcosm of time, that's the band that's one of my favorite bands, you know?
Right. And it's for me, too, like you say, with Pete Willis, a lot of people think that, oh, Def Leppard kind of died musically after Steve Clark died. But for me, you know, like you said, Pete Willis was one of the main songwriters of the band, too. And they were never going to sound the same after he left. You know, I still like him. I still like pretty much everything Def Leppard's ever done. But that's when the sound of the band really changed, was after Pete Willis was sacked.
Yeah, and there, one other big change was, you know, there was a certain arm that went missing.
Yeah,
so you had the combination of Pete Willis and that missing arm that, so they really changed a lot after that. But yeah, that, and so, yeah, I always say the Pete Willis years, and I'm including Pyromania in that because, you know, I mean, like I said, I think Phil Collins played maybe two guitar solos, and that's pretty much it.
Willis did a lot of work on that record.
Yeah. I think for me, it goes Cheap Trick, Slade, Kiss, and then Def Leppard. I mean, they're one of my favorite bands of all time, and they've been one of my favorite bands for, you know, 30 years. One of the first bands I got into, and to this day, I can still put on any of those first three records at any time and love it just as much as I loved it back then. I mean, nothing has changed, you know?
No, I agree. And just substitute Slade, they'd be in my top 10, but I would probably substitute them with Thin Lizzy. We're pretty close there.
Oh, yes. Well, Thin Lizzy are right up there. That's for sure. Yeah. So you would rank, you're saying that your top four would be the same, except just substitute Thin Lizzy for Slade?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, there you go. Well, we have very similar taste then. Yeah. I guess we'll just start off by just kind of talking about the beginnings of Def Leppard before we get into the album. So they started out as a high school band called Atomic Mass, which formed in 1977, and only two of the future members of Def Leppard were present for that, Rick Savage and Pete Willis. And I think even like the very earliest beginnings, Pete Willis wasn't there either. So kind of Rick Savage kind of started the whole thing that eventually turned into Def Leppard. But Atomic Mass was just a cover band. They didn't have any originals. And from what I read, they only played one gig in a school gym. But at that one gig in the audience was Joe Elliott. So school ended, and the singer for Atomic Mass, whose name was Paul Holland, he went off to college. And that's when Joe Elliott comes into the picture. He says that he got the gig with no audition just because he had a cool record collection. And I think his story is that he ran into Pete Willis. Maybe it was at a music store. And asked him if he wanted to form a band. And Pete Willis was like, well, I already have a band. And then Joe Elliott ended up joining that. And I think he was playing drums. I think Joe Elliott was playing drums. It's interesting how many, it's interesting how many singers, famous singers, started out as drummers, like Steven Tyler and different people, you know?
Dave Perner, Soul Asylum.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So, yeah. So Joe Elliott joined, that's still in 77, I think. Yeah, and they played their first show with him in December of 77. And so I think at that point, even though Joe Elliott came up with the name Def Leppard when he was in high school, I think they were still called Atomic Mass at first.
I'm pretty sure that's correct.
Yeah. And yeah, I mean, there's the famous story of how Joe Elliott would write that name on his notebooks. And, you know, he had this fantasy of having this band, Def Leppard. And that first gig they did with Joe Elliott, they did do one original. It was a 5-song set, 4 covers and an original called Misty Dreamer. And then it's January of 1978 when Steve Clark joins the band, and I mean, that's a huge moment, of course. And it says, I read that Joe Elliott and Pete Willis met Steve Clark at a Judas Priest show, and he auditioned by playing the entire Freebird guitar solo.
Yeah.
So and then the first 2 songs they wrote after Steve Clark joined were Rock Brigade and Wasted. So I mean, are a couple of pretty great songs to write, right? Yeah, so he obviously was a very important addition to the band. And then July 78 was the very first public gig for this new band, and now they were called Def Leppard. I'm not sure when exactly that happened, but from what I read, I think they played like 8 shows as Atomic Mass before Joe Elliott joined. And that first gig as Def Leppard was at Westfield School in Sheffield. And then their first professional club gig was in September of 78 at a place called the Limit Club. And at that show, they played on the same bill as another local Sheffield band called Human League, which is pretty interesting. I mean, of course, Human League probably started out as more of like a post-punk sounding band. I'm not sure what their earliest stuff sounded like, but they might not have started out as just like a synth band. I'm not sure, but Def Leppard didn't play a lot of shows in 78 because obviously they were just honing their sound and writing songs like crazy. And all, at that point, their drummer was this guy named Tony Kenning, who apparently he's the one who came up with altering the spelling of Def Leppard so that it resembled Led Zeppelin, which was a pretty good idea. Because Joe Elliott's original name, I think he just spelled, you know, Def Leppard correctly with the A and the O in there and everything. But Tony Kenning apparently was compelled to leave the band by a girlfriend who felt neglected. So, oops. so he quit the band, and then so at the time when they recorded their first EP, which was in November of 78, I believe, they recorded three songs for a self-released EP, and they had a drummer for that session named Frank Noon, who was from a, I guess, another Sheffield local band called The Next Band, but he opted to stay with his band and not join Def Leppard. So when they recorded that first EP, I mean, they're still teenagers. They're all still teenagers. And that first EP was Ride Into the Sun, Get Your Rocks Off, and they called it The Overture for that. And but so they had that, they recorded that EP, but they still didn't have a permanent drummer. And I think Rick Allen was like a friend of a friend or something like that. He was 15, and I read that he auditioned with Emerald by Thin Lizzy, which is maybe my favorite Thin Lizzy song.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a pretty awesome audition. These guys obviously had great taste in music. But
definitely.
Yeah. So that self-released EP comes out in January of 79. So that's really early for, you know, thinking about like new wave of British heavy metal. I mean, that's, you know, it's almost 78. They recorded it in 78. It comes out in January of 79. And then all through 79, they record some more demos and played a lot of gigs. So they spent 78 writing songs and just getting tight. And then 79, they just, you know, went full throttle, played a lot of shows. And July 79, they did a showcase for record labels where reps from 11 labels were there, and they ended up signing with Vertigo Phonogram, which I believe Vertigo was also Thin Lizzy's label over there. So yeah, they get signed pretty quick. I mean, obviously, they're still teenagers when they get the record deal. Maybe Joe Elliott was 20 by then, because I think he was born in 59. The rest of the guys still teenagers, and obviously a lot of natural talent. You know, there were so many bands that formed at this time, but you know, none of them were as good as these guys. Just these guys, just there's the, must have been a great chemistry, but it was also just a lot of natural talent that went into this band, obviously, because it happened so quick for them, where they make this record. Well, first they put out a single. They recorded a single for Vertigo, which was Wasted in Hello America, and those are different versions. They re-recorded those for On Through the Night. That they recorded in November of 79. And I guess that single is what got them noticed. Cliff Bernstein was working as A&R for Mercury Records at the time. But I think the way it worked is that he left Mercury so that he could start a management company and manage Def Leppard. I'm not sure if that was his motivation for starting to go into management or not. But so it's Peter Mensch and Cliff Bernstein that, you know, signed the band to a management contract.
Peter Mensch, they'd met him because he was managing AC/DC. And they approached him about possible management. And I think that's when he and Cliff Bernstein left, because he was part of Lieber Krebs management,
right?
Which was a big rock management at the time. And he left them to form a new management company with Cliff Bernstein. And I think you're right that like Leppard was one of the first bands they had under their belt.
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could see these guys are going places, because you have these young kids that are already so good. It's just, you know, like, where are they going to go from here? So,
and that was one of the things like that attracted to me to them when I was in high school, finding out how young they were. And I'm like, oh, these guys aren't that much older than me.
Right.
You know?
So. Yeah. So they released that single, and then they did a couple of short stints in the UK. They opened for Sammy Hagar for some shows, and then they went on an AC/DC tour for a little while. And then they go into the studio with Tom Allom producing, who was already legendary. Worked with Sabbath and Judas Priest, and they record their debut album from November 79 to January of 1980 at Starling Studios, which I guess was Ringo Starr's home studio.
Oh, wow.
Is where they recorded. The record was a success pretty much right when it came out, top 20 in the UK, and it debuted at number 51 on Billboard, which meant something quite different back then.
Oh yeah.
but it's funny that the hardcore fans of the band from the club days and stuff, they were not happy with On Through the Night, especially like the production, which is weird since Tom Allom, you know, Sabbath, Judas Priest, and then the metal guys perceived the production On Through the Night as like a sellout. I started right then this cynical attitude that Def Leppard were just trying to, you know, they were trying to be successful in America. They had their sights set on America, and people, the European metal community held that against them, I think. Of course, the song Hello America didn't help.
Yeah, so I say that didn't do them any favors.
But it's funny that
for the UK audience, at least.
Yeah. It's funny, when Joe Elliott wrote that song, he had never even been on an airplane. So it was just a fantasy. Yeah, basically the On Through the Night record was written and recorded by teenagers. And like I was saying, it's readily apparent listening to this record how insanely talented these guys were, that they just had a natural talent and just a ton of potential. Considering these are the first songs they ever wrote, to me it's really, really impressive.
Right. You could obviously tell they had a lot of ambition and that they wanted to go places.
And if you look at the material that was being produced at the same time by like hundreds or even thousands of other bands, the whole new wave of British heavy metal and everything, there are very few, of those hundreds of bands that had any material that really even held a candle to the quality of these songs. I mean, there's a lot of cool songs in the new wave of British heavy metal, but Def Leppard just, you know, stood apart for sure from most of those other bands, pretty obviously.
That I agree with that too, and not only was it the music too, but with Joe Elliott, you had a voice that was different than everything else you were hearing from that scene too.
Yeah, that's true.
And they had, even though it wasn't a punk style to their music, it was definitely a punk kind of do-it-yourself and youthful attitude to the music. I mean, because like they went out and recorded that first EP, put it out on their own label, Bludgeon Ripola, which they would later revive, and everything since probably Pyromania or High and Dry has been released on Bludgeon Ripola via whoever else. So
yeah, and Bludgeon Ripola actually came from a negative review of the band where the reviewer was saying their music was just Bludgeon Ripola, but it was a negative, it had negative connotations. But yeah, they took that for their record label name, which is a pretty cool record label name too.
True, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they, you know, Iron Maiden also self-released their first single, but Def Leppard beat them to it. And so really, though, I mean, those were the two most important bands in that new wave of British heavy metal, and two very different bands that kind of had a different set of influences and a different approach. But, you know, looking back these days, most people would not put Def Leppard and Iron Maiden in the same kind of category or think of them even as peers in like the same genre, but they totally were at the beginning.
Right. Unless you grew up in that scene, you know, if you grew up with that scene, I think you would always make that association. But like looking back on it now, I would agree, like you wouldn't think these two bands came out of the same scene, you know.
And they were pretty much equally as important, I think, at the time.
I would agree. Yeah.
Of course, they went off in very different directions.
Oh yeah.
But
speaking of that part too, that's something that Def Leppard has always been accused of, even from this first album, is selling out.
Yeah.
And to me, it's not selling out if trying to be the most successful band you can be and reach the most wide mainstream audience you can. If that's the ultimate goal, then you're not selling out. That's achieving the goal. But I get where people would say that. But I mean, to me, that was always their aspiration. Like, we want to be the biggest band. We want to reach the most people we can. And so you're not selling out if that's what you're trying to do.
Yeah, and that's a good point. Here they are. This is their first record, the very beginning of their career, and they're already being called sellouts. So yeah. I mean, that's just followed them through the whole way. But I mean, I know I've seen Joe Elliott say he doesn't consider them a heavy metal band.
No, yeah.
Definitely, at this time, they were considered a heavy metal band by everyone.
Yeah, and I would say so right up through the first three albums, even, too.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't really get the first super taste of commerciality until Pyromania, but the first two albums especially, they were definitely a metal band for the standards of the time. you know, I considered him a metal band back then, you know.
For sure. But, it's just that what heavy metal means has changed.
Right.
Has shifted away from that kind of a sound. But yeah, back then, that High and Dry, it's as heavy metal as it got back then.
Right. I mean, the Metallica and Megadeth were in their very early stages at that point. And Anthrax, these bands hadn't even really come onto the scene yet.
No.
So like the heavier stuff, you know, that most people would associate with real metal now, like you have Priest, you know, Priest was metal then, you know, or still are, but I mean, not as heavy as some of those other bands. It's just metal, like you said, what metal became didn't really exist yet.
Right. Yeah. You know, January of 79, when that first EP comes out, there's not a lot. Besides, like, Judas Priest, there's not a lot going on yet. They were right at the beginning of, you know, what turned into heavy metal in the 80s. So, to me, the big difference between a Def Leppard and Iron Maiden is just influences. You know,
right.
Def Leppard incorporated a lot more of, like, the glam. You know, Joe Elliott loved, like, Sweet and Slade and everything. And
Mott the Hoople, and yeah. You get to that covers album they did, and you could tell it's all glam. You know, most of that record is all glam covers.
Yeah, and then Iron Maiden had more of a prog influence, and then more focused more on like the hard rock bands like UFO or something, which of course I'm sure all the guys in Def Leppard worshipped UFO as well.
Yeah, and you can tell that on this first album.
Yeah.
UFO, Thin Lizzy, there's a lot of references to those bands on this record.
Yeah, so personally, I don't have any problem with the production of On Through the Night. You know, they improved after this record, and they tightened things up. And these are the first songs they ever wrote. I guess, you know, if people who had just seen the band live a bunch of times and then they hear the record and it must have sounded completely different to them. But, you know, you go into the studio and you know, yeah, they were trying to make an album. They weren't trying to make a live recording.
Right.
And I guess, you know, Tom Allom, you know, I don't know how much of the sound of the record is the producer or how much of it was the wishes of the band and, you know, what went into it. I mean, there's a lot of arrangements on these songs and, you know, and some of the stuff they tried on this record, it doesn't really work or, you know, it sounds a little bit dated or, you know, that you could tell they were really young and inexperienced, but, you know, it still really stands out as a great record from the time.
Right. And to me, it's like, if I have any issue with the production, that it is very much of its time. It does sound like 1979, 1980. It's a little dry and flat in places, especially kind of like the drum sound. But that, if that's the worst I can say about it, that's not that bad.
Yeah, and certainly the production doesn't hamper how good the songs are. And
no.
And when you just look at it song for song, it's a hell of a good album, in my
opinion. Oh, yeah.
So I guess we could just go track by track then. Is there anything else you want to say about the beginnings of Def Leppard or just the album in general?
I think we pretty much got it.
Yeah, okay. So, of course, the record kicks off with Rock Brigade, which we already said is one of the very first songs they ever wrote as a band after Steve Clark joined. To me, this song is a perfect example of just the natural raw talent present with these guys. I think it's a combination of natural talent and you've got huge music fans with lots of records. They listen to a lot of songs. They really appreciate songs. And, you know, they've learned just from listening to other bands and other songwriters, they've learned how to write a song, even if it's subconsciously. So I think that's how you combine that natural talent with an appreciation for a great song. And this is what you get. You get young guys who they already know how to write a song and they're just going to get better at it. And, you know, this is a song written by teenagers. And Rick Savage called it a fusion of Judas Priest and Queen, which I think you could kind of hear the Queen part would mainly just be the harmonies. But
right. And, you know, it's a killer riff, great yeah. album opener. And back in a 1993 Guitar World interview, Dimebag Darrell listed it as one of his 12 favorite guitar solos of all time, was this song.
Oh, yeah, and when you listen to the early Pantera stuff, you hear a huge Def Leppard influence. In fact, their album Projects in the Jungle, it seemed to me like they were just trying to write High and Dry, the High and Dry record for a lot of that.
Yeah, those first few Pantera albums don't sound anything like that. Talk about going from like one thing to an extreme difference, but that's what I remember when hearing Pantera way back in the day on Metal Shop, and that's what I thought too. I'm like, God, these guys kind of sound like Def Leppard.
Yeah, I mean, what's the first? I think the first song in Project in the Jungle is called "All Over Tonight." I think it's called, and it sounds like it came off High and Dry. It's got the same dynamics and everything. It sounds like they were, in fact, I would say they were trying to write a High and Dry song when they wrote that song. That's what they had in mind. So,
I would completely agree with you.
Yeah. So, Rock Brigade, to me, I love it. Amazing. Oh, amazing song.
Definitely one of the highlights of the record.
Yeah. And
with a lot of highlights.
Yeah. And the production is cool on this song. I don't have any problem with the production.
Me either. And they still play it live to this day occasionally. This is one of, I think, like two or three songs off this album that they are still known to play live occasionally.
Yeah. I know the band, I think they're kind of a little bit embarrassed about On Through the Night just because these are the first songs they ever wrote. And, you know, maybe they're like, Rock Brigade? What are we talking about? You know?
Yeah.
But, you know. Whatever, who cares? It's awesome. The second song is "Hello America," which had been on the early single.
Hello America, hello America, hello America, hello America.
This is one of my least favorite songs on the record, actually. Maybe second to last if I would rank the songs on here. Which shows how great an album this is, because I like the song. It's a fine song, but it just doesn't have a great hook on the chorus. I just don't think it's kind of as well-crafted or melodic as the rest of the songs on here. It's kind of unfortunate it's the second song on the record.
And it's heavy metal Beach Boys. I mean, yeah. Especially when you get into like the bridge section, it's a heavy metal version of Surfing USA. It is.
So this has never been one of my favorites personally, but, it was a single and a video and everything. So it's too bad. But
although the video is kind of cool to go back and watch now and see like Joe Elliott with the perm and, the glam outfits and stuff they were wearing was pretty kind of crazy.
Yeah, if you look at the back cover of this record, you know, the picture, Pete Willis looks like he's 12, and Joe Elliott looks like he's maybe 14. I mean, it's crazy how young they look.
And they weren't far off from that.
Yeah, right. It's funny, because Pete Willis is a little guy and everything. He really just looks like a child on the back of this record.
Oh, yeah.
And we didn't even talk about the album cover, which, pretty classic. classic.
I can't remember what the other album is. There was some other album from this time. I meant to look it up and I forgot. But it's a very similar album cover. Like, was it Hypnosis did this album cover? It looks like something they would do. But it was very similar, and it had sort of the same sort of theme where, like, it was a truck or something hauling it with, like, maybe a big guitar or, you know. But it was very similar, but the cover was red. And I cannot remember the name of the band, but I remember seeing, like, these albums at the same time, and you could, like, hold them up, and they were almost like two pieces of the same picture. God, I wish I could remember what the band was now, but
I don't. That doesn't ring a bell for me of seeing that, but that would be really interesting.
It may have been like somebody like Nantucket or something, which Tom Malone also produced. But God, I have to look that up. I wish I would have remembered that. I just thought of it now. But this was also the only Def Leppard album, I believe, to feature this logo for the band, where it was kind of like in the triangle, right? And
yeah.
The F had like the little backflip at the bottom and two lines through the F instead of one.
Yeah, so. I can still draw the Def Leppard logo from memory for sure.
I used to draw this all the time in like art class. I actually used to paint pictures of the band and stuff in art class. All rock bands actually back then, but.
Yeah, I used to put all these logos on my notebooks and my folders, and I'm sure I could still do the Iron Maiden logo no problem from memory.
Oh, God. Yeah.
But yeah, great logo. The album cover is completely ridiculous, but definitely, you know, of the time. It's kind of like it's even better quality, but, you know, there was some status quo album covers around this time that were pretty similar to this kind of ridiculousness. But I'm sure people have seen it, but it's a semi hauling a giant guitar through outer space or something like that.
Right. And speaking of the title of the album, this is something that they would do following in kind of like Led Zeppelin and a little bit AC/DC's footsteps,
right,
where the title of the album would actually be a song on the next album,
right,
not on this album. Like On Through the Night is on, the song is on High and Dry, not on here. So that was kind of something that always used to confound me when I was younger. It's like,
which I don't know. Also, I don't know if they had the song On Through the Night when they made the album or if they wrote it later. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I never found that out either.
It's never, I mean, there was never an early demo version of it or anything like that. So, maybe, I don't know. Maybe it's a song that was in progress that they hadn't finished, but they had the title and ended up using it as the album title. It's a good album title. I'm not sure how On Through the Night inspired that record cover, but.
Yeah. And it's a good song too. On the other album,
yeah.
But that's that album. This is this album.
Yeah. So. All right, well, so the third song, probably my personal favorite song in the album. Song called Sorrow is a Woman, absolutely brilliant in my opinion, and not exactly a heavy metal song really by any stretch, but I think this song shows a very clear Judas Priest influence, because there were a lot of Judas Priest songs like this, and I think
you can
really hear the appreciation for like the softer and more melodic side of Judas Priest in this song, and also some Thin Lizzy in here as well. It's like a hard rock ballad. But what a great song. And to think how young they were when they wrote this. This is an amazing song.
And when you get to that harmony guitar solo, it just takes it to another level.
Yeah, great piece of work. It's probably my favorite song on here. Song number four, It Could Be You. This is an awesome song. Great riff on the verse. Very rocking verse, and then kind of a big shift on the chorus, but it really works. It's a cool arrangement, a pretty creative song. Kind of comes across as a simple song, but it, I mean, if you think about it, it's not. It's really inventive, and I think it's great.
Yeah, I agree. I think it's got a good riff, but otherwise, I'd qualify it as good, but not awesome. But this was one of at least, I think, four tracks where Pete Willis was actually the main writer of the song.
Yeah.
Just to show like how much of an influence he actually did have on this band.
Oh, huge. Huge.
Yeah.
He was a huge part of the sound of the band, for sure.
That's the one thing I've never been able, unless you see videos, it's a lot of times the only thing I've had a harder time sussing out is it Steve Clark soloing? Is it Pete Willis soloing? Because back at the beginning, it was kind of, their styles were very similar, and it was kind of hard to tell.
Right.
But from what I've been able to glean, it's pretty much anytime you've got a more bluesy almost, which is, we'll get to in one of these other songs, a more bluesy, almost Angus Young kind of solo style, or a lot of wah guitar, that's usually Pete Willis soloing, because he liked to use a wah and soloing a lot. Although there are a couple tracks where it's Steve Clark using a wah, so that's another thing that just makes it confusing is who's who.
Next song, Satellite. This is a great song. I probably like the melody on the verse even more than the chorus, which I could probably say about It Could Be You too. But I think this is the song on the record more than any other where there are a lot of the elements of the future Def Leppard sound in this song. I think this is probably the song here that hints the most at things to come with High and Dry and Pyromania.
I would agree with that. It's a very Thin Lizzy vibe to the song. Another great solo. I like the cool, arpeggiated breakdowns of the guitar parts. But yeah, this is where you would definitely get that twin guitar attack of Def Leppard would really show on this one too.
Yeah, it's got a great atmosphere and a very pretty breakdown. You know, it's very melodic. It's a
right.
Really well-written song, and yeah, I mean, you know, in retrospect, I think you can kind of see Pyromania coming on this song. So then the last song on side one is When the Walls Came Tumbling Down, and this might be one of those moments where one of those songs that the band are more embarrassed about, I think, maybe.
This is definitely one that dates the album.
Yeah.
And has that little spoken word intro and kind of like that was something else that was very much of its time where, you know, let's have this a moody kind of atmospheric song with this little spoken word intro. And they kind of, I don't know, maybe Joe Elliott nicked that from David Bowie in the beginning of Diamond Dogs or something. But in a way, and I hate to say this, but it's almost very Spinal Tap-ish looking back on it now.
Yeah.
And kind of Stonehenge. But yeah. But overall, I think the song is really good. And this is something else I remember we talked about at the Tesla show. Is like I could see this song being something that influenced Tesla. Like it's very much got Tesla. You can see Kyle Tesla may have taken this and used some of it for their sound.
Yeah, sure. I can see what you're saying. Yeah, I think the spoken part is... I think his name is Dave Cousins from Straubs is the person who does that.
Oh, wow.
On the first day of the first month, in some distant year, the whole sky froze gold. Some said it was the aftermath of the radium bomb, while others told of a final retribution, a terrible revenge of the gods.
It's an ambitious song. I don't know if it quite achieves what the ambitions were, but just because they were so young and, yeah, I mean, I don't know at what stage they wrote this song. Maybe, I don't know if it was one of the last ones written or, I don't know. It's not a great song. It's good. It's still good. But like I was saying, when they look back at this album and they're like, oh, I don't want to hear that. Oh, no. You know, and they blush or whatever. This would probably be one of the main song maybe that would make them feel that way. I don't know.
Right. And most of the music was written by Steve Clark. And then Joe Elliott did the lyrics. And there is an outside writer, Andrew Smith, who is credited to this track.
Oh, yeah. I read about, I think that's like one of their childhood friends or something. Maybe yeah. He had some of the lyrics or something like that.
But it's the only song on the album with an outside writer, so.
I always wonder, like, what kind of checks that guy got in the mail. Just because his name was on that, you know? All right, so moving on to side two.
Slash heavy upstairs.
kicks off with a song called Wasted, which, I mean, what a riff. What a riff.
That's Steve Clark. That is where, you know, you got the riff master that was Steve Clark. And when you talk about, like, him coming up with great guitar parts, this is the beginning of it.
Yeah, and as the story goes, the band was rehearsing and Steve Clark was late. And when he got there, he comes running into the rehearsal space, runs over to his guitar, grabs it, and starts playing this riff because he just came up with it in his head on the bus riding over to rehearsal. And I love this quote from Rick Savage that I wrote down. He says, I'll never forget seeing him play this riff that nobody had heard before, but the whole band thought it was amazing. And, I mean, what a story. I love that.
I know. And it's still to this day one of my top, it would be one of my top 10 favorite Def Leppard songs, easily.
Yeah, this is a killer song, a killer new wave of British heavy metal song, just a classic of like that genre. Total classic, of course. Not just a classic Def Leppard song. This is a classic heavy metal song and a classic.
Oh, definitely. Like if you were to make a new wave of British heavy metal compilations, I think this would have to be the one from Def Leppard you put on it.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, then we move on to Rocks Off, the second song on Side 2, which was also on their first EP. This is my least favorite song in the record, personally. It's a cool riff, but it's not a great melody. There's no hook on the chorus because basically the chorus of the song is the riff, which is fine. I don't hate the song, but it never done much for me. It's always been like my least favorite on here.
This is where I disagree. This is one of my favorites on the album.
Really?
I like it. Well, you know, and here's why. Pete Willis played the guitar solo on this one.
Right.
And I kind of like the boogie feel to it, kind of status quo maybe. I like the key changes where then it kind of shifts keys towards the end of the song. I kind of like, even though it's like the pan stereo effect of the parts of the solo, I think that's kind of neat. I mean, would I say it's, you know, awesome? No, but I definitely like it. This is one of my favorites off the album.
Well, you know, this is a record. This is one of those rare records where I could put this record on and listen to it all the way through. I'm not going to want to skip anything. The whole record is great. So this is my least favorite on here, but I'll still listen to it. I'm not going to skip it, you know. And as a whole, this album is killer all the way through. So...
Well, the next track is definitely one of my favorites on the album. It Don't Matter. I've always thought this one sounds like a little bit like early Kiss.
Yeah.
It's got another great wah-wah solo, kind of like the slide guitar. And you can tell that it was, to me, I hear a lot of Ace Frehley in the guitar on the solo. And that's what I hear. It's just especially the rhythm part of it. I always thought, wow, this sounds like Kiss. Or early Kiss, I should say.
Yeah, I can hear that. Yeah, this is an example of what I was saying about Rocksoft. This song has a great opening riff, but it's just a piece of the song. You know, it's not the whole song.
Right.
And then there's a lot more going on with this song than there's a good hook on the chorus and everything. So, I mean, I wrote down that it's a simple song, and it's not an amazing song, but I like it. I love it. You know, it's great.
Right.
I love this kind of music, so, you know, it totally works for me. But it is pretty simple, especially compared to maybe a lot of the other songs on here.
Oh, yeah, I agree. But in a way, that's, I guess, kind of what mine reminds me of Kiss.
It's yeah, like true. Just, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's a pop song, and it's good chorus and everything, so.
Pretty sure. At least, I think they both play solo on this, but I'm pretty sure that this is another one where it's Pete Willis on the solo, especially because there's a lot of wah going on.
So the next song, Answer to the Master, it's another very riff-based song like Rocksoft. Cool verse, but not much of a chorus. But I guess I like it more than Rocksoft for some reason. But it's pretty similar kind of construction of the song. Not one. It probably, you know, it's in the bottom half as far as when I would rank the songs. But I like it. Like I keep saying, I like every song in here. There's not a song right. I don't like. So
yeah, if there was one track on the album to me that I would say was kind of rote, it's this one.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not a bad song, but it's just not a great song. And again, I hear a little bit of Ace Frehley in the guitar solo, which is fine with me. And you know, I'm a Kiss fan, Ace Frehley fan, so that was not a negative by any means. But otherwise, it's just, I don't mind hearing it while it's on, but otherwise it doesn't do much for me.
Yeah, I would say When the Walls Came Tumbling Down and Answer to the Master seem like the two songs they spent the least amount of time on.
Right.
That's what I hear, is maybe they were the last two songs written. They were written just so they had enough for a record. That's kind of the vibe I get from those two, maybe, that they're just not as well thought out and put together and as inspired, maybe, as the rest of the songs. But
right.
But still good, because, you know, these guys, you know, even if they're not trying, they could still write a good song. So.
Yeah, and again, in this one, another one that sounds very much of its time. This sounds like what metal was back then, whether it be Judas Priest or UFO or whoever. That it sounds like something you would have gotten from one of those bands.
Yeah, I think the biggest influence that you hear on Through the Night is Judas Priest, personally.
Well,
would be what, and I think you hear more than anything else,
which is natural considering the producer, the guy who produced pretty much most of Judas Priest's albums.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
Bye.
Yeah, and you know, Overture would be an example of Judas Priest had, you know, had very similar songs to this, kind of an epic song that they closed the record out with. And this was on their early EP, but they called it The Overture. They took off the part for the record. And yeah, this is like their magnum opus. If you picture a group of ambitious teenagers writing this song, then I think it's pretty inspirational. It's very melodic, starts out mellow.
Right.
Kicks in with great guitar harmonies, and it's obviously it's a great way to end the record. And it's funny, yeah. we were talking about Iron Maiden. This is as close to Iron Maiden as Def Leppard ever got, probably.
Yep, that had that in my notes too. And in a way, a little bit Southern rock. You know, yeah. You went back to that part where how Steve Clark auditioned with Freebird.
Exactly.
There are parts of this, especially like the harmony guitars and just the riff of it. Melody, it sounds like something you would hear in a Southern rock song, when like they would play those big epic open tracks and like three guitar players playing at the same time soloing. I kind of get that vibe from it too. Not that that's a bad thing, but you know, you can hear the Judas Priest, you can hear a little UFO, you can hear a little Queen, and you can hear a little Southern rock in it too. But to think that this was one of the songs that was on that first three-song EP that they did, and then, you know, obviously they were going to include it on this album, but like you said, that just shows the vision that they had even back then.
Yeah, and the ambition. Yeah. That, you know, they probably, I mean, this song was written because they wanted to write a song like this, you know, and so
right.
they tackled that kind of a project.
And to show they could.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, and it's great. I think it's great. So
yeah.
I'm not sure the band probably, you know, they probably don't agree.
Yeah, well, yeah, like, now they might go look back and go, what were we thinking?
Yeah.
Pretentious little snots, you
yeah,
know,
exactly,
something.
Yeah, definitely. But
it works.
Oh, yeah, it works great. I love it. I think it's awesome.
Yeah, a great, great closing cut to the album. Like, great way to close out the record.
Yeah, and how long is this song? It's probably like 7 or 8 minutes or something?
7:44, just right. Under 8 minutes long.
But it doesn't feel too long at all. It's awesome.
Solid start to Def Leppard's career. And it actually, like, I didn't come to this record first. I think, like a lot of people, I discovered them with High and Dry. Like, I first saw the band opening for Ozzy Osbourne on the Blizzard of Oz tour, and to me they blew Ozzy off the stage, and I was like, oh, who, I gotta go out and have this band's album. And went out and found High and Dry, bought that, and I'm like, oh, they got another album out too, because I didn't even know that High and Dry wasn't their first record. So I went out and immediately bought On Through the Night too, and went back and then went forward from there. But like this just as much. I mean, still, if you would ask me, High and Dry is my all-time ultimate favorite Def Leppard album, but, you know, this is up there too.
Yeah, right. Yeah, same here. High and Dry is my favorite, but that doesn't mean this isn't a great record.
Right.
For me, an album that there isn't a single song I would skip is kind of rare.
And, right.
Like on Pods and Sods, they say classic album tag. I mean, this one definitely gets that. That's for sure.
I would give it a classic too.
Yeah.
And it's funny too, because it definitely follows the Shabby Road record show thing of like the first song on side two, the single. You know,
yeah wasted. Right. Well, I mean, yeah, that was the perfect song to put as the first song on side two for sure.
Oh, yeah.
As well, And I can't get over how great that story is of Steve Clark coming up with it on the bus.
Yeah.
And how Rick Savage is like, I will never forget that moment. Because you can just picture these young guys and how just the whole concept of having this band. And he runs in and starts playing this riff. You're like, holy shit.
Yeah.
Such a great story.
It is, too. And I, that's the thing, going back, and it had been a while since I put this record on, going back and kind of re-listening to it for the show, I was like, wow, this is definitely a stronger record than I remember it being. So,
yeah,
that's a plus.
For a band's first album and everything, it was pretty successful right away, even though we talked about, like, the backlash. And, you know, they got some backlash in the press and everything, too. Jeff Barton gave them a bad review. But then Circus Magazine declared them the best new band of 1980. So that shows the whole UK versus America.
Right. And even Barton has gone back and said that he was overly harsh of his review of the first album. And looking back on it now, he would change his opinion.
Right.
Now.
Yeah, it was, I think it was kind of, I guess to the people that loved them and from the club days, it was kind of a shock to hear what the record sounded like when it came out. I guess I can't look at it from their point of view, but yeah, so that they came to America, they were on a Pat Travers tour for a while, and then they toured the US for this record, opening for Judas Priest. And then they were just on their way from there. But more than anything on Through the Night, I think you hear potential. You know, in retrospect,
yeah,
you're like, yeah, these guys are going places. And They changed a lot. I mean, there's a they High and Dry hardly even sounds like the same band, really.
No.
So they really found their sound quick and nailed it down.
Right.
And so this is an interesting, the On Through the Night's an interesting document of like the first songs they wrote and just a very young band just starting out. And I guess On Through the Night is much more influenced by other things, and then they really just started to create their own sound, you know, right away with High and Dry.
Well, I think that's a good point too, because I think with this album, like, that's kind of the difference between this record and High and Dry is the producer. You get a guy like Mutt Lang, who was at that point still pretty just up and coming in himself, and you get a right producer who's like, and the right they have a vision, he has a vision, and they kind of have the same vision, and that's when you get a record like High and Dry. Whereas this, it's like, here, we're a young band, we pretty much know what we want, but you are the expert, you know, help us kind of get that sound. And it's kind of like Tom Allen Malone, however you say it, it's kind of like him going, well, this is what I know, and this is how we'll make this record. Because I think that's where he brought like the experience he had with Priest and kind of applied that to what Def Leppard wanted to do. Whereas I think it was a little bit more collaborative between Mutt Lang and Def Leppard, and then they had more of the same vision of what they wanted.
Yeah, and I could totally picture Mutt Lang saying, you know, stop trying to be Judas Priest, let's figure out who Def Leppard is.
Exactly.
Whereas yeah. Tom Allum, they probably were like, we want this to sound like Tom Allum produced it. Well, then it's going to sound like Judas Priest. So,
right.
And yeah, Mutt Lang, you know, he's coming from producing like City Boy and stuff like that. So a very different, you know, and Boomtown Rats. And I'm trying to think of what he did before.
Highway to Hell.
Right.
And I think he hadn't done Foreigner yet. I think Foreigner was after this. I think it was like, yeah, 404 was like 1981, 83, so it would have been after this. But he'd just done AC/DC, and obviously they were, you know, having worked with AC/DC, having a manager who's worked with AC/DC, that's probably how they got the in with Mutt Lang.
Right.
And it was, I think it was just, like I said, like he saw what they wanted to do and agreed with it, and it just all worked out to a better thing. But yeah, like this album is definitely a great blueprint for what was to come with the band. Not a bad record by any means, you know, really great album, but definitely different from the rest of their catalog and probably why you don't hear it as much. It's really a shame. Back in the mid-2000s or the late-2000s, they were going back, Mercury was going back and doing those deluxe editions of the Def Leppard records, and it's a shame that they never did one for High or Dry or On Through the Night, because there is a lot of material that they could have stuck on as bonus stuff, but...
Yeah, there's a ton.
I wish... It's too bad they never did it, because it would have been great to just round out the rest of the band's classic early catalog with those, because the other ones, the ones they did for Pyromania, Hysteria, and Adrenalize are really nice.
Yeah, there's and a lot of other songs that they recorded. You probably have that First Strike album. Do you have that?
I do. It's on cassette, of all things. And I found it in a Sears back in the day. That was the only place I ever saw it. It was on the racks in Sears at one point. I was just like looking through their stuff, and I'm like, oh, my God, I've never seen this before, and picked it up and bought it. But I've never found it on vinyl.
Yeah, I have it on vinyl. I don't even remember where I found it. Yeah, I had it on cassette at first, too. At some point, I found it. There's a really cool song in there called See the Lights that is a pretty poppy song. Yeah, I mean, they had a lot of other stuff. They had Good Morning Freedom was released as a B-side, and that's like a heavy... That's one of their more like new wave of British heavy metal songs. They had a lot of other material, yeah, that could have been great bonus tracks on a reissue for sure. And then they could put, you know, the original versions of Wasted and Hello America. And yeah, they could put together a really great like 2-CD set.
Yeah, because between like the First Strike and the Def Leppard EP, you know, there's a whole bunch. And just the other stuff that didn't even get put out necessarily. There's a ton of great material.
Well, thanks a lot, Joe, for talking to me about On Through the Night.
You're welcome.
I'm sure it was just as much fun for you as it was for me. Because
it was. And like I said, you know, I could talk about any Def Leppard album anytime. So I'm very excited. And like I said, really psyched to be able to talk about one of the Pete Willis ones. It's too bad he got sacked. But, you know, I guess he just... His alcohol consumption was just a bit more excessive than everybody else's, and he didn't seem to take it as the group as seriously. Like, you know, from what I read, is like he would like just come into the studio drunk and just not think it was a big deal because they all drank. But you know, that was just not going to fly once you had somebody like Mutt Lange in the studio working with them, and they just had aspirations where he just like, whatever, you know. And he had a bit of short man syndrome too, so.
Yeah, he was very short. Yeah. And now to play us out.
What does that mean? To play us out? I don't know what that means, to play us out. What does that mean? To end the show?
Yeah.
All right, so we're going to leave you with a song we mentioned earlier that not sure when they recorded it, probably sometime in 79, called See the Lights. There's this album, I guess it's sort of a bootleg thing called First Strike that came out. Probably, I guess, when Pyromania was big.
1984.
Yeah, somebody put... It's not like a major label thing, but I think it's also maybe a step up from a bootleg. I'm not really sure. I don't even remember where I first got it or anything. I know I had it as a kid, but this song always stood out for me from that album. It's called See the Lights. Till next time. So I'm
I'll be back.